Good afternoon, listeners. This is the Dogs Program, and we're here every Saturday to defend and promote public education. And we have a lot of interesting work for you today. After last week, of course, it may not be quite so activist, and we have to thank Annie for all the work she did so that we could hear what our teachers in public schools had to say. And they have every right to be out and fighting, because we have underfunded public schools and overfunded private ones. And here's our press release 1065, and Andy's going to read it to us.
Thanks, Jean. And this is the Australian Council for the Defence of Government Schools press release number 1065. Underfunded public schools, overfunded private ones. The gap grows. The following evidence of gross inequality in education funding and the systematic undermining of the Australian public education system, as illustrated by Trevor Cobbold in Pearls and Irritations of March the 27th, 2026, is the reason why Dogs have opposed state aid for private religious schools since 1964. Private schools are pulling further ahead as funding policies deepen inequality across Australia's education system. New school income data show that Catholic and independent schools have increased their resource advantage over public schools in Australia. This trend has been driven by sustained increases in government funding, combined with growth in fees in private schools. Decades of favourable funding for private schools is a key factor behind the enrolment shift to these schools. Public schools are massively underfunded, while private schools are overfunded. The figures from the Australian Curriculum Assessment and Reporting Authority, ACARA, show that in 2024, total income per student averaged $20,368 in public schools, compared with $22,067 in Catholic schools and $28,642 in independent schools. Generous government funding, Commonwealth and State Territory, underpins the resource advantage held by private schools, with government funding representing around three quarters of Catholic school income and nearly half of independent school income. Catholic schools receive approximately $16,590 per student from governments, while independent schools receive about $13,826. Long-term trends since 2009 indicate that real government funding increases have been stronger for private schools than for public schools. After adjusting for inflation using a combined wage and consumer price index, real government funding rose by $3,118 per student in Catholic schools and $2,729 in independent schools between 2009 and 2024. Over the same period, public school funding increased by a smaller amount, $2,154 per student. In percentage terms, funding growth in Catholic and independent schools was double that in public schools, 40%, 43%, and 20% respectively. Increased government funding and fee increases have magnified the resource advantage of independent schools. In 2009, the total income per student in independent schools was $4,066 higher than in public schools. By 2024, this had increased to $5,460, and their total income per student was 141% of that of public schools. Total income per student in Catholic schools was slightly below that of public schools in 2009, but since 2011, they have a significant advantage over public schools through generous government funding and fee increases. Public schools are massively underfunded in all jurisdictions except the ACT. For example, public schools in New South Wales, Victoria, Queensland and the Northern Territory are funded at less than 90% of the Schooling Resource Standard, the SRS, required to ensure successful school outcomes for all students. The total underfunding in 2026 is estimated at $6.5 billion. While the new bilateral funding agreements between the Commonwealth and state and territory governments will provide a substantial boost in funding of public schools, they will remain underfunded to 2034 and beyond. State and Northern Territory governments can continue to claim non-SRS expenditures as part of their share of funding public schools. They can claim capital depreciation of up to 4% of the SRS, some school transport expenditure, and expenditure on regulatory bodies. These expenditures are specifically excluded from how the SRS is estimated because the SRS is a measure of the resources needed in schools to deliver successful outcomes. Government claims that public schools will be fully funded by 2034 are a blatant lie. While the 4% allowance will be phased out by 2034, governments will continue to claim regulatory expenditures as part of their share of funding public schools. By contrast, private schools in all states except the Northern Territory are overfunded and will remain so until at least 2029. For example, Catholic and independent schools in several states, including New South Wales, Queensland and Western Australia, are funded at 102% of their SRS in 2026. The favourable treatment of private schools is also apparent in the new funding agreements. While the states can claim non-SRS expenditures as part of their share of funding public schools, they are not permitted to do so for private schools. Private school students also benefit from school transport subsidies, and the remit of school regulatory bodies also includes private schools. The jarring dichotomy in government funding policies towards public and private schools is scandalous, because it is public schools that do the heavy lifting in educating young people. The Report on Government Services 2026 shows that 80% of students from low socio-educational backgrounds, 81% of Indigenous students, and a similar proportion of students in remote areas attend public schools. Nearly one-third, 32% of students in public schools are from low socio-educational backgrounds, compared to 14% in private schools. Research by Save Our Schools shows that 90% of all disadvantaged schools are public schools. The persistent underfunding of public schools has significant long-term implications. Students entering public schools today may spend much, if not all, of their entire schooling years in institutions operating below resource standards considered necessary for equitable outcomes. This, in turn, may perpetuate educational inequality, social segregation, and constraints on national productivity and economic growth. To address these concerns, governments must accelerate the transition to full funding of public schools. The funding agreements must be revised to give public schools better and fairer funding. The Commonwealth should accelerate the increase in its funding share of the SRS public schools to achieve 25% by 2029. State governments should remove the existing 4% allowance for non-SRS expenditure by 2029 and immediately remove new non-SRS expenditure claims as part of public school funding. Overall, sustained policy reform is needed to reduce funding disparities between sectors. Ensuring adequate and fair funding for public schools is critical, not only for educational equity, but also for broader social and economic objectives. Back to you, Jean.
Well, thank you very much, Andy. And I think we have to remind ourselves why our teachers had to go out on strike after 13 years. Let's hear about it, shall we?
Thanks, Jean. This is a press release from the AEU. Public school teachers, principals and education support staff stopped work. For the first time in over 13 years, public school teachers, principals and education support staff stopped work for 24 hours following the inability of the Allan Labor government to put a fair and decent pay and conditions offer on the table. AEU Victorian Branch President Justin Mullaly said there are significant and ongoing staffing shortages affecting schools across the state, as Victorian public school staff continue to be the lowest paid in the country and increasingly overworked. This is occurring at the same time as Victorian public schools are the lowest funded in Australia, with schools funded in 2026 to the same level they received in 2023. As well as missing out on $2.4 billion through to 2031 as a result of Premier Allan's decision to delay a full funding deal with the federal government. Victorian public schools have a serious workforce shortage because excessive workloads and uncompetitive pay are driving experienced staff out of the profession and making it difficult to attract the next generation, Mr. Mullaly said. This should be completely unacceptable in any state or territory, let alone for a Labor state government which prides itself on calling Victoria the education state. After more than 9 months of waiting for a reasonable offer from the Allan government and rejecting a completely unacceptable deal last week that did not do enough to properly and fairly deliver pay increases and address excessive workloads, teachers, principals and support staff have been forced to take stop work action. Victorian teachers, principals and support staff would much rather be in the classroom teaching Victorian students, but because of the disrespect from the Allan government, they are having to stop work for 24 hours, Mr. Mullaly said. If the Allan Labor government really values the work of Victorian teachers, principals and education support staff, they must come forward with an offer that addresses their real concerns. A recent survey showed only 30% of staff plan to stay working in public schools long term, while more than 80% say their workloads have increased due to inadequate support. By September 2026, experienced teachers will be earning as much as $15,359 a year, that's $295 per week, less than their New South Wales counterparts. A classroom-based education support employee starting out would be 10.5% behind, and a Victorian school principal new to the role would start $27,841 or 18% behind a similar principal in New South Wales. Our students and their families do not deserve to have teachers, principals and education support staff that are underpaid and undervalued. Instead, the delivery of high-quality public education requires that they are properly respected and paid what they are worth, Mr. Mullaly said. The Premier and the Education Minister need to act immediately on this and on delivering full funding through an agreement with the federal government which lifts Victoria off the bottom of the funding pile and delivers the resources in full like other states and territories. Following this stop work, Australian Education Union members are ready to escalate their industrial campaign if necessary to ensure that a fair and decent offer is made by the Allan Labor government. Back to you, Jean.
Thank you, Andy, and thank you, Dale, and let's have a quick break.
Help us stay radical. Become a regular donor to 3CR. A regular donor is someone who loves 3CR so much that they set up an automatic donation to 3CR on the same day every month. Will you help 3CR by becoming a regular donor today? Together, we can keep independent voices on air. Go to 3cr.org.au.
Well, you're still listening to the Dogs program. We are interested in the universities, particularly what's been happening to them in recent times. There was a very interesting article that we found on this, and Sol's going to tell us all about it.
Thanks, Jean. This article is written by Hannah Forsyth and is entitled Australia's Universities Have Found Themselves in Crisis, but it has been decades in the making. Rather than a set of teaching and learning relationships, universities have become a bunch of metrics to be gamed. Unwinding these systems will take effort. Universities are in crisis. Federal and state government inquiries point to serious problems with governance, financial transparency, and managerial decision-making. The pressure on university leadership, particularly well-paid vice chancellors, is mounting. After decades of public shaming, some university executives are finally starting to suggest that their social license might require them to earn a more average wage. It comes at a time of relentless, often unexplained, staff cuts for professional and academic staff. In some cases, Safe Work New South Wales has issued stop work orders due to psychological harm. Things are hardly better for students, who are facing a world in which affordable housing is often out of reach and intergenerational inequality has been exacerbated. They are also facing growing levels of student debt, which is needed, students are repeatedly told, so they can have a job one day, even as the threat of AI looms. All this seems to have snuck up on vice chancellors. But in fact, the present crisis in universities was decades in the making. Changes to the global economy in the 1970s meant that by the 1980s, if you were making widgets in Dubbo, you might now order parts from Japan 1 month and Taiwan the next. Industries found themselves having to adjust quickly. Unable in general to control currency values, most tried to do things more cheaply to keep customers. Austerity measures were often disguised as working smarter, not harder. But mainly, the outcome was laying down a path for inshittification, crappier materials or longer wait times. By the second half of the 1980s, the federal government had stepped in to consolidate higher education institutions, spread the load of tuition costs, and expand university enrollments. This shored up Australia's rapidly changing workforce by preparing more people for white-collar professions rather than blue-collar manufacturing jobs. This meant many more university students. Growth exploded again after 2000. It wasn't just in Australia. Over the next 20 years, university enrollments worldwide more than doubled, and white-collar work grew rapidly. More bosses in highly paid jobs. Globalization meant that organizations needed lots more decision makers. Among rapidly growing white-collar professional occupations, none grew as fast as managers. With all those extra students, universities became big and complex. The number of university managers multiplied. The relationship with government changed too. Management were asked to make decisions in response to complex levers, meaning systems of incentives and disincentives. While these measures sought to influence what management did, they were also a way of market making, turning higher education away from what political leaders thought of as bureaucracy to businesses. Fans of managerialism reckoned the old ways were ossified, a word applied to banks and hospitals as well as universities, as if stuck in 1950s monotony. New managers would try to make organizations agile and flexible to respond to the new global economy. But as I wrote in Virtue Capitalists, this puts bosses at odds with other kinds of professionals, including academics, but also healthcare workers and others. Academics wanted to do their job well, while bosses sought ever more austerity, as globalization demanded. This austerity didn't seem to apply to their own salaries, which surged even as other workers' wages stagnated. Management started to see academics as a workforce to be tamed and controlled, rather than collaborators in an educational mission. The third change that led to the present crisis is the marketization of education. It was in the early 1980s, when young people were temporarily reluctant to study, that universities started to advertise. The slump in demand didn't last long, but marketization only ramped up. This skewed the way that bosses saw the mission of the university. Rather than a set of teaching and learning relationships, universities were now a bunch of metrics to be gamed. But how do we fix things? One thing that history shows is that things were not always like this, and they don't need to be now. Change is difficult, as university bosses like to tell the people whose lives they upturn. What took decades to build will take some effort to unwind. Higher education commentators typically see three possible solutions. The first is to make government fix it, usually with more funding that we hope this time might go to something other than a shiny building. A second is to reorient policymakers away from market levers to the public good. Those are a good start, but I prefer a third, which is to better connect universities to community with more democratic internal decision-making systems. University bosses, after all, are part of the problem. I don't think much will change while they are the only ones in charge. Back over to you, Jean.
Well, many, many thanks, Sorrel, for that very interesting article from The Conversation. But as we know, since the 1980s, the economic paradigm has been private is good and public can be just underfunded or not funded at all. And the universities are in trouble because we've been asking students to pay fees, some upfront. The Chinese students, particularly the children from overseas, have been keeping our universities going with pretty steep fees that their parents have to pay. And then, of course, there's the HECS debts that the rest of the young people in Australia have had to pay. So they're a bit fed up. Let's hear about it, shall we, from Andy.
Thanks, Jean. Why Chinese student numbers are expected to take a sharp turn for the worse in Australia. And this was published by the ABC on the 29th of March. Chinese students remain the largest international student cohort in Australia, and they continue to provide the lion's share of revenue for Australian universities. But experts have warned that could soon change. In February, Department of Home Affairs data confirmed forecasts that Chinese student numbers to Australia have been declining. It showed there was a 25% drop in the number of student applications over the first half of the 2025-26 financial year, following a 12% decline over the 2024-25 financial year. The data came after a report from Moody's Ratings in January predicted Chinese student numbers in Australia would take a sharp turn for the worse after 2030. Experts say there are many factors driving this trend. People more selective amid uncertainty. Grace Lee, a Law Faculty Associate Dean at the University of Technology, Sydney, also looks after Chinese international student recruitment for the Law Faculty. She said one factor was China's uncertain domestic economy. People are more selective and more sensitive in making a major financial decision in terms of sending their child to study abroad, she said. Melbourne-based migration and education agent Sean Dong said studying in Australia could cost about $50,000 to $60,000 a year. Combined with rising living expenses, he said it was a significant investment. Professor Lee said Australia's skyrocketing temporary graduate visa application fee, which recently doubled, could soon be another factor. Student numbers are also predicted to decline further with China's falling birth rate. What we're seeing is demographic decline, which poses risks to long-term demand for Australian universities, said Moody's analyst Matthew Kirkoster. The agency said Australian universities should look at pivoting away from the Chinese market. China's plunging birth rate combined with its ageing population have also fueled predictions of a long-term decline in the country's economic growth. As of October 2025, there were 192,225 Chinese international students in Australia, accounting for 23% of the total 833,041 international students, according to Department of Education data. More students studying closer to home. Professor Lee said an Australian university degree was once seen as a golden ticket to a good job, but that was no longer the case. Tightening domestic labour market also means jobs could be harder to get. Official figures showed the youth unemployment rate in China had been steadily increasing from 10% in 2018 to a peak of 21.3% in 2023. While it has since eased, it remains relatively high at 16.3%. In China, overseas graduates are also no longer guaranteed high-paying jobs, and the halo effect of an overseas degree has vanished in the eyes of many Chinese employers, experts say. Chinese students are not just turning away from Australia, but also from the United States and Canada, according to a report from the Institute of International Education released in November. Meanwhile, a 2025 report from the consultancy group Highmark Group in China found more Chinese students are choosing universities in Asia. Natalia Tan, who chose to study law at China's Peking University in 2019, said tuition fees in Australia were already expensive when she had been considering her options. Ms. Tan said many of her peers were now opting for universities in Singapore, Hong Kong, Japan, or South Korea. She said the customs and culture were more familiar in those countries, so it was easier to adapt. Peking University's Juris Doctor program also ranked higher than Australian universities' programs, she added. In 2019, the number of Chinese universities in the world's top 100 has surged, according to major rankings. Top universities in China, including Tsinghua, Peking University, and Fudan, have all improved significantly. Moody's analyst Mr. Keir Costa said the rise in the competitiveness of Chinese institutions would likely continue to reduce demand for overseas education. Studying in Australia encourages open-mindedness. Chinese students already in Australia say there are benefits to studying here. Iris Yu is set to complete her bachelor's degree in law at the end of this year. The main purpose of studying in Australia was that I wanted to go out and see the world to experience it for myself, Ms. Yu said. Sydney is quite international and I have made friends from all over the world. For Ms. Yu, 3 years in Australia have provided a lesson in open-mindedness, a quality she believes is a deep-level takeaway that can only be gained through immersion. These are things that can only be truly experienced after living abroad, especially Australia, for a period of time. How Australian universities are responding. In response to questions about the Moody's rating forecast, Universities Australia Chief Executive Luke Sheehy said international education in Australia was a major success story. It's essential that we protect and strengthen this sector through stable, predictable policy settings that keep Australia competitive, Mr. Sheehy said. Analysts said universities need to diversify their income sources and not rely so heavily on international students. Diversification matters, but it takes time and certainty, Mr. Sheehy said. It should strengthen the sector, not come at the expense of long-standing relationships. Professor Lee urged Australia to be proactive if it wanted to continue attracting international students, which some critics have described as cash cows. If we don't take action, this cash cow is going to die, she said. She suggested expanding transnational education by delivering Australian degrees in China or other countries. That allows more students to access Australian education without the full cost of studying abroad, she said. China has recently approved a record number of joint education programs, including several involving Australian institutions. Meanwhile, Australian universities are expanding offshore campuses in Asia, including in Malaysia and Vietnam. Back to you, Jane.
Thank you so much, Andy. And now it's time to go overseas with Jeff.
Good afternoon, listeners. I'm going to start this week in Africa with an article by Ellen Chigwanda, which appeared in the Brookings Institution blog. Chalk, Courage and Climate Change, How Educators in Eastern and Southern Africa are Transforming Challenges into Action. Climate change as a daily classroom reality. In many classrooms across Eastern and Southern Africa, climate change is not a distant scientific concept. It's a daily lived experience. Teachers are not just explaining rising temperatures or erratic rainfall patterns, they are navigating them. They're teaching adolescents and youths who come to school hungry because drought has wiped out family crops. They're improvising lessons under trees during heat waves or in makeshift spaces when floods destroy school buildings. This blog is grounded in the insights and experiences of teachers at the front line of climate disruption, drawn from research carried out in schools across Zimbabwe, Malawi, South Africa, Kenya and Rwanda. Their reflections reveal a story of hardship and challenges, yet they also stand as innovators through resilience, creativity and leadership in the face of climate crises. Through this research, teachers provide recommendations about where targeted investment in technology, infrastructure and professional development could significantly strengthen outcomes. Climate change has far-reaching implications for environmental systems, human health, economic stability and social development. In Africa, in particular, faces heightened climate vulnerability, despite contributing minimally to global emissions, making education even more crucial for building local adaptive capacity. Climate change itself disrupts education systems. Extreme heat, flooding, and drought contribute to poor concentration, health challenges, disrupted access to schools, and reduced learning outcomes. Climate change education, CCE, has increasingly become a critical focus within the research as current scholarship focuses on pedagogies, barriers, teacher experiences, and systemic needs in the delivery of climate education. In addition, education is widely acknowledged as a core mechanism for building climate resilience, empowering individuals and communities with knowledge and skills required for adaptation and mitigation. International frameworks such as the UNFCCC and the Paris Agreement emphasise education as an essential pillar of global climate action. The power of participatory and culturally rooted climate education is the next headline. Scholars argue that effective African CCE must move beyond Eurocentric models and incorporate indigenous and decolonised knowledge systems and approaches, which are deeply contextual and culturally embedded. Such approaches improve relevance and community ownership, contributing more to sustainable behavioural change. creativity plays a strong role in, across African contexts. Drama, storytelling, debates, art, games and music are used to simplify complex climate concepts and increase youth engagement. This mirrors wider findings that participatory pedagogies effectively build disaster risk reduction skills and climate literacy. Recent research calls for a shift from traditional theory-heavy classroom instruction towards place-based experiential learning. A 2025 study in Ghana demonstrated that field-based climate learning greatly improves learners' environmental stewardship, social change advocacy, and climate action competencies. These transgressive pedagogies encourage learning that disrupts conventional models, grounding education in lived experiences and local socio-ecological realities. However, across eastern and southern Africa, teachers face severe resource shortages, limited digital devices, inadequate internet access, insufficient textbooks and poor infrastructure, hindering effective teaching. Similar challenges were documented in South Africa, Nigeria and Kenya, where educators often lack clear strategies for integrating climate education into standard curricula. Multiple studies highlight gaps in teacher preparedness, with many educators lacking specialised climate knowledge and pedagogical guidance and training in adaptation and mitigation strategies. Exacerbating this, higher education institutions report that climate impacts slow academic process and damage educational infrastructure. The reviewed literature consistently highlights the urgent necessity of climate education for Eastern and Southern African resilience, while underscoring the superiority of experiential, participatory and culturally rooted pedagogies, the existing chronic resource and training gaps that limit teacher effectiveness, and the potential for education systems to act as community climate resilience hubs. Collectively, these studies reveal that while African teachers face significant constraints, they also possess unique contextual insights, and with proper support, they can play a transformative role in climate adaptation and mitigation. What the research reveals, teachers' experiences across 5 countries. The dataset used to develop this blog included 29 teachers and educators and over 200 adolescents and youths across Kenya, Malawi, Rwanda, South Africa and Zimbabwe, who were engaged via individual interviews and focus group discussions in a cross-country study exploring innovative climate education practices as well as barriers and resource needs. Participation of teachers in the research varied significantly by country, with Zimbabwe contributing the largest group of educators, 16, followed by Malawi, 5, Rwanda, 4, and smaller cohorts from Kenya and South Africa, 2 each. Despite these differences, the demographic profile shows a near gender balanced cohort with 15 male and 14 female teachers. Most educators work in rural areas, 65%, where climate risk is greatest and infrastructure weakest, compared to 27% in urban and 6.9% in peri-urban settings. Access to technology, a key enabler for climate education, remains uneven. Although all educators have mobile phones or tablets, only 72% have internet access or televisions, 48% have radios, and just 41% have laptops or computers. These disparities shape how effectively teachers can obtain climate information, integrate digital resources, and deliver media-based climate education lessons. Overall, the dataset reveals a highly committed yet consistently under-resourced group of educators operating on the front line of climate-impacted education systems who are constrained by limited tools, connectivity and institutional support, conditions that directly affect their capacity to deliver effective climate change education. For many teachers, climate change is no longer a topic restricted to geography books. It's unfolding right outside their classroom windows. Floods wash away bridges, having learners stranded and unable to attend class. Heat waves lead to dizziness, dehydration and poor concentration. Droughts contribute to food shortages, leaving young people hungry, distracted or absent altogether. And when school buildings are damaged by storms or heavy rain, lessons simply cannot take place. Educators describe these challenges not as occasional disruptions, but as the new normal, conditions that now shape school calendars, attendance patterns and the emotional lives of learners. Despite these constraints, educators have not retreated. They have adapted, often in beautifully creative ways. Teachers are turning scarcity into innovation. With limited textbooks, unreliable internet or a complete lack of projectors, teachers are relying on what they do have, their voices, imagination and the resourcefulness of their adolescents and youths. They use drama, role play and poetry to simulate climate impacts. Songs and music help learners remember concepts. Storytelling grounded in local events, failed crops, broken bridges or extreme heat. Teachers are bringing learning outdoors. Teachers are creating micro demonstration sites, planting trees, establishing waste sorting corners or running school garden plots. Adolescents and youths learn about soil erosion by observing gullies behind their school blocks. They learn about afforestation by planting seedlings themselves. Teachers are using real-life crises as teaching moments. Teachers are using crises as opportunities for delivering climate education content. Drought becomes a case study for water scarcity. A storm becomes an example of extreme weather events. A failed harvest becomes a conversation about mitigation and adaptation. These teachers are not just talking about climate change, they help adolescents and youths understand it at the deepest, most personal and practical level. Amid innovations, the toll on teachers remains. On the other hand, climate education is demanding and teachers are feeling the weight. Many educators report teaching without tools such as internet, reliable electricity, radios or televisions, up-to-date textbooks, laptops or projectors, or printed learning materials. For some teachers, even chalk is reported as a precious resource. Teachers described being overworked, undertrained, and note that they face multifaceted barriers, high teacher-student ratios, the expectation of covering multiple subjects at once, a lack of specialised climate education training, burnout, and a limited time within tight school timetables. Teachers are carrying the pressure to deliver irrelevant, accurate climate information while lacking opportunities for professional development. In addition, some adolescents and youths feel climate change is not for young people or see it as irrelevant to their lives. Teachers also noted that some youths are too overwhelmed by hunger, household chores, family responsibilities, lack of interest or cultural misconceptions about the new climate change behaviours to engage in climate education. Teachers are teaching hungry and heat-stricken learners. Food insecurity, dehydration and climate-related illnesses shaping the emotional and academic climate of classrooms. Thus, teachers encounter resistance, learner apathy or fear, and most gently break through those barriers and teach against attitudes and realities. Across the five countries, teachers reported a shared struggle with chronic resource shortages, but the severity and accompanying challenges varied considerably. Some educators also grappled with communication difficulties and low learner interest, which together restricted meaningful engagement. Other teachers' experiences were compounded by overwhelming workloads, teacher shortages and disruptions linked to socioeconomic instability and climate-related disasters. In some places, the lack of resources were further intensified by the curriculum gaps and insufficient teacher training. Across the data set, resource gaps remained the dominant challenge, but teachers additionally noticed weaknesses in community, parental or student engagement alongside limited training opportunities, suggesting that broader social dynamics shape the learning environment. These cross-country patterns reveal a region where teachers consistently confront under-resourced classrooms, but do so within distinct national contexts. Together, the data illustrate both shared structural barriers and the diverse realities shaping climate education across Eastern and Southern Africa. Teachers as community climate leaders. Teachers are doing far more than just teaching. They're mobilising entire communities around climate resilience. They're leading environmental action, spearheading tree planting drives, clean-up campaigns, recycling initiatives and anti-burning awareness sessions and water harvesting projects. Teachers are modelling sustainable behaviours and inspiring adolescents and youths to do the same. They are connecting with community and partnering with NGOs, local leaders, government programs, churches and media outlets, radio, TV, WhatsApp groups. They're acting as the bridge between information and action, helping families understand why early warning systems, drought-resistant crops, sanitation and disaster preparedness, how they help. Many educators are teaching adults, not just adolescents and youths, sharing climate knowledge in community meetings, church gatherings or through the door-to-door interactions. They've become mentors to entire villages. This study found that teachers are offering rich insights into what truly works to engage young people in climate education, including play-based and experiential learning, drama, art, debates, games, music, were repeatedly cited by teachers as powerful teaching tools, especially in communities with limited technology. Peer-to-peer learning. Teachers reported that adolescents and youth teaching each other is transformative. As such, youth clubs become climate ambassador hubs where knowledge flows freely and confidence grows. Localising content. Teachers note that adolescents and youths respond best when examples come from their own environment. Local droughts, rising river levels, waste challenges, burning practices and crop failures. Chicha said that context-based teaching transforms abstract ideas into lived reality. What teachers need to succeed. Despite their ingenuity, teachers are clear about what would make their work more effective. Resourcing the climate classroom, educators are asking for ICT tools, computers, laptops and phones, internet or Wi-Fi access, textbooks and printed materials, projectors and radios, weather instruments and solar power for schools in off-grid areas, training and professional development, regular workshops, mentoring, updated climate content and curriculum materials would empower educators to teach confidently and accurately. Recognition and incentives. Many teachers feel unseen. They long for acknowledgement of their efforts, more support from leadership and meaningful opportunities to make decisions and influence climate policy and curriculum. In every district represented in the data set, one thing is clear. Teachers are not passive observers in the climate crisis. They are innovators, protectors, mobilisers and mentors. They are guiding young people not only to understand climate change but to act on it, to lead, to think critically and to build communities capable of weathering storms both literally and metaphorically. They are leading adolescents and youths into a climate-resilient future. Their work is courageous. Their creativity remarkable. Their impact is generational. The data from this research is positioning teachers as unsung climate heroes, shaping the next generation's resilience and environmental consciousness. Teachers are calling for policymakers, NGOs, donors and communities to centre them in climate action strategies. East African governments are beginning to integrate CCE into school curricula by coherent, coordinated policy implementation, although some of that remains lacking. National policies must incorporate teacher training, resource allocation and monitoring frameworks to be effective. Investing in teacher professional development requires continuous training in order to improve literacy, pedagogical confidence and the ability to contextualise scientific concepts. If the world is serious about addressing climate change, then supporting these educators, resourcing them, training them and celebrating them must be at the centre of the strategy. They are planting the seeds of resilience and leadership in every lesson, every club meeting, every community gathering, and from those seeds, a more climate-resilient generation is already beginning to grow. So again, that was by Ellen Chigwanda. Now we're going to go to a sort of slightly fun one now. We're going to a story from FIDE, which is the International Chess Federation, an article by Arkady Dvorkovich, who's the FIDE president of the International Chess Federation. His story comes from Costa Rica. The title of the article is Latin America at the Forefront of Chess in Education Policy. The Summit on Chess in Education held in Costa Rica on the 20th and 21st of March brought together experts from across Latin America to discuss how chess can support learning. He begins, since I became president of FIDE in 2018, one of the key goals has been to develop chess as a tool for engagement, inclusion and education. This idea has found support not only in chess, in the chess world, but also among teachers, psychologists, clinicians, scientists, social workers, humanitarian organisations, governments and many others. As part of this work, FIDE named 2025 the Year of Social Chess. Building on the efforts led by FIDE Deputy Chair Dana Rizanis, we declared 2026 the Year of Chess in Education. For us, social chess and chess in education are not slogans. Together with international organisations and state institutions, we have held events, seminars, conferences and competitions across the world, promoting the concept and inviting all interested parties to provide ideas, questions and solutions. In each place, we showed how chess can become part of daily life, regardless of background or circumstance. We already know that full integration is possible. In Armenia, chess has become a mandatory subject for primary schools since 2011. The program has been successful, which has also reflected a number of highly rated players from the country. Latin America is at the heart of the project. Several essays on the region describe a strong wish to use chess as an educational innovation. They also point to gaps in coverage and limited institutional backing. Long-term programs began when school leaders and classroom teachers see chess as part of learning, not as a hobby on the side. Political engagement in the region is growing. In 2024, the federations in Honduras, Trinidad and Tobago and Costa Rica invited Jerry Nash, chair of the FIDE Education Commission, to visit schools and meet ministers to discuss large-scale plans. His visit helped local teams prepare proposals for national or regional programs and raised awareness of chess as an educational tool, not only as a sport. Later visits across the Americas by Victor Bolligan focused on chess in education and youth development, and continued this work of linking chess projects with finance, sport and education authorities. In 2025, at the Smart Moves Summit in Washington, D.C., the Costa Rican Minister of Sport and Recreation, Donald Rojas Fernandez, presented results from pilot projects in schools. The data showed that classroom chess can support better academic performance and stronger social skills. It's therefore natural that the second global conference on chess in education is now taking place in Costa Rica, a country that is setting standards for how chess can serve society. The Summit on Chess in Education in Costa Rica will launch a national pilot that brings classroom-based chess to 10 public schools. The program is built around inclusion, student well-being, and simple implementation for teachers. This project will be continuously observed, and pending successful evaluation, the plan is to extend it nationwide. Thus, the successful project can turn into a national strategy written into education plans and budgets so that a child in a rural public school has the same chance to learn through chess as a child in a capital city. For Latin America and the Caribbean, the Year of Chess in Education provides a clear moment and a common goal. My team at Federación Internacional des Échecs and I are committed to supporting and promoting this goal, and we're looking forward to the conclusion and recommendations from the Summit on Chess and Education. And that's the end of the article. I just thought it was a fun one. Why not play more chess? It's something that can be played around the world and links schools everywhere. And with that, I'll pass you back to headquarters of the Dogs. Cheerio.
Thank you very much, Jeff. Let's have a quick break.
3CR programs provide information and analysis you won't hear in the mainstream.
Today we'll be looking at the legacy of the US war on Vietnam on Laos.
And as far as corporate capitalism is concerned, it is the worst political and economic system that you can have.
Our laws about jailing refugees and asylum seekers are so well crafted.
Sex is not irrelevant, and we like who we are, but we don't have to be imprisoned by our gender.
Become a subscriber today. Call us on 9419 8377 or visit 3cr.org.au. 3CR, the voice of dissent.
Help us celebrate 50 years. Subscribe.
Well, we hope you're still listening to the Dogs program because this is the best part of the program. Public schools are the best. It doesn't matter what the private schools say because they are only just additional to anything that the public can do. And parents discover this very quickly if they go to a public school. We've got a very interesting article here, which a group of public school parents are in the inner city of Sydney that have discovered just how good public education can be. Over to you, Dale.
Thanks, Jean. This is an article from The Age by Christopher Harris, "The Public Parents Fighting the Flight to Private School." When Stephanie Dunstan enrolled her son at Glebe Public School, she did not realise what she was getting. It's not until you're in the school that you realise it is an amazing school, she said. Glebe has its own music teacher, a band program, and extremely strong growth in NAPLAN scores compared to other schools. Essentially, the school was the whole package. But Dunstan, who is now the president of the school PNC, realised it also had two problems. It had lost about 100 enrolments since the pandemic and is not doing a great job at selling itself to future parents. From other parents I speak to, other schools do not have a band program or a lunchtime writing club, she said. It is the stuff people want. It's what I imagine is offered in private education, a chance for their child to play great music or write short stories and have a great librarian who inspires critical thinking. Like many schools in the inner city, inner west and eastern suburbs, Glebe Public is seeing dramatic declines in kindergarten enrolments as parents either opt for private or Catholic schools or simply leave the area because of surging rents and house prices. People are leaving Sydney. It's just too expensive. They're going out of the inner city and going to the Central Coast, Queensland or Tasmania, Dunstan said. There's this realisation that public education has been undersold. It's not great at communicating how good it is. To fight the flight from public schools, she is attempting to raise Glebe Public's brand awareness in the community. The PNC has produced a 12-page dossier highlighting the school's achievements, with parent testimonials, information about after-school care, and details of literacy and numeracy gains for current students. If you're a prospective parent trying to understand the options, it's really hard to understand what makes a school tick. The public school websites, all although very recently improved, are really basic and you don't have a sense of the school and the community, she said. Last year, parents at Waverley Public successfully lobbied the Department of Education to install a selective stream for Year 5 and 6 students. Parent Arne Tran Nam said since then the program had proved extremely popular to existing high potential students as well as attracting new ones. Students have joined from both government and independent schools, overall attracting students to the public sector, she said. A Department of Education spokesman said its new program, called Inspire, was providing gifted students opportunities to challenge themselves and thrive across academics, the arts, leadership, and sport. Schools are actively sharing more information about the opportunities available for students with their local communities and prospective families, he said. Across all schools, department technicians have worked to install new websites and strict enrollment rules have been relaxed in a bid to attract more students. To stem the flight to other schools, the department has launched a campaign highlighting famous and successful public school alumni. It declined to answer questions on whether that campaign had improved enrolments. Social researcher Mark McCrindle, who is also on the board of Independent Schools New South Wales, said private schools were typically better at communicating the essence of their school community and their offering. What a great example at Glebe, where a government school is doing the same thing, he said. He said research showed that while parents valued academics, they were drawn to the extracurricular activities on offer and the sense of community. In the past, you didn't need schools to provide extracurricular activities because children might have been in scouts or a sporting club or youth group in church. And yet these days, young people are less connected. Really, parents are outsourcing that to the school, he said. Glebe Public parent Alina Ma, who assisted the campaign, said it could be difficult for new parents to gain information about schools. She said, "It is hard for schools to self-promote. The school websites are dictated by the Department of Education, so we were just saying, how do we tell people?" Brady Downs, Managing Director of Look Education, a marketing agency that has worked with public schools in other states as well as private schools, said independent institutions were better resourced to produce bespoke websites, professional photography, digital campaigns, and brand development. Public schools often don't have that same level of budget, and in many cases, key assets like websites are delivered through department-wide templates. While that creates consistency, it can also make it harder for an individual school to clearly express what makes it distinctive. He said community trust mattered more than advertising alone. The school's community, parent advocacy, and word of mouth often becomes some of its most effective marketing tools, he said. Back to you, Jean.
Well, thanks, Star. People who actually send their children to public schools realise that they're on to a good thing and that the private schools are merely parasitic. But there's no prize for guessing what the great state school will be this week.
Thanks, Jean. And this week's great state school of the week is Glebe Public School. And from their website, what we can offer your child. Student success. Our school provides a high-quality, low-cost education that supports every child's growth. We're proud of our students' success in learning, competitions, and life beyond school. A welcoming community. Our school is a place where students from all backgrounds feel safe, respected, and part of the community. We value diversity and fairness. Your child will learn and grow in a school that celebrates who they are. We prepare students to be confident, well-rounded, global citizens. Glebe Public School is a kindergarten to year 6 comprehensive co-educational primary school in Glebe. We are proud to be part of a strong public education system and welcome students from all backgrounds and cultures. Our vision at Glebe Public School, our vision is to foster an inclusive, vibrant learning environment where every student flourishes and reaches their full potential. Tailored learning support. We know every child learns in their own way. That's why we provide tailored learning support to help each student do their best. Our programs meet different student needs. This includes high potential and gifted students, students with additional needs or disability, and those who need wellbeing support. At our school, your child will get the support they need to succeed. A world of opportunities. We offer a wide range of programs and experiences to help them thrive. From STEM and sport to the creative arts and more, our broad curriculum encourages curiosity and critical thinking. And now some facts and figures from the My School website. The school has 193 pupils and the ICSEA value is 982, which is below average. This is an inner city multicultural community. 26% of students have parents from the upper 25% in income, 21% in the second quartile, 19% in the third quartile, and 35% from the poorest 25% of the community. 66% of the pupils have a language background other than English, and 26% are of Indigenous parentage. This is a school with students from a very diverse backgrounds with a dedicated principal and teachers. It costs the taxpayer $21,906, below that of any private school, to educate a student at this school. The school receives only $1.04 million from the federal government and $3.6 million from the state government, $40,000 from fees and $518,732 from private fundraising, and only $698,000 for capital grants in the last 3 years. All this public and private money is money well spent. The NAPLAN results indicate that the children in this school are progressing even better than children in similar circumstances. Back to you, Jean.
Congratulations to the Glebe Public School, and our time is gone. If you want to find out more about the dogs, then we've got a website, so you can always go to www.adogs.info. It's up to me now to thank our wonderful producer Dale and her offsider Andy, and of course Sol and Jeff, but from all of us here at 3CR, it's bye for now.
I dreamed I saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he. I never died, says he. In Salt Lake City, Joe, says I, him standing by my bed. They framed you on a murder charge, says Joe, but I'm dead. Says Joe, but I'm dead. The copper bosses killed you, Joe. They shot you, Joe, says I. Takes more than guns to kill a man, says Joe, I didn't die. Says Joe, I didn't die. And standing there as big as life, and smiling with his eyes, says Joe, what they can never kill, went on to organize. Went on to organize. From San Diego up to Maine, in every mine and mill, where workers strike and organize, it's there you'll find your hill. It's there you'll find. I saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he.
Says he.
Thanks for listening to a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We rely on the financial support of listeners like yourself to keep going. Will you help 3CR by becoming a regular donor today? Together, we can keep independent voices on air. Go to 3cr.org.au. And thanks for your support.